Daf Chaf Aleph, Amud Aleph, three lines up before the end of the Amud. The Pasuk says in Shmuel Beis, Vatikach Tamar Efer al Rosha. So Tamar puts ashes on her head, Uksonas Apasim Asha'ola Kura'a, and she renders the garment, the beautiful wool, fine wool garment that she wore. And all this is as a public statement of Avelus. And Tana Mishmei de Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha, we learn in the name of Rabbi Yeshua, Geder, Goder, Godol, Godra, Tamar Biosa Shah. Basically, Tamar in that case was publicizing her humiliation, and this was a tremendous gader. The Torah says that we should make gedarim, we should make fences around the Torah. Since this terrible thing had happened in a relationship between a brother and a sister, she made a gader. Amru. And when people saw her public humiliation, they declared, Livnos Malachim Kach. Livnos Malachim Kach. They made a Kal Vachomer. If such a terrible thing could occur to the daughter of a king, Livnos Hedyotos Alachas Kam Vakama. How much more so to the rank and file citizen? We have to make some sort of protection so that the daughters of Israel will stay far away from such a situation. Imlitz Nuos Kach. Tamar was a modest girl, and yet look what happened to her. Leprutzos Alachas Kam Vakama. How much more so could happen to an immodest girl? Therefore, we have to make a gader, somehow a fence around the Torah to avoid such a situation, and that's going to be the Isur Yichud, as the Gemara formulates right now. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Rav, the Osa Shah. As a result of this terrible incident between Tamar and Amnon, is Gazru, and here we're turning to Daf Chaf Aleph, Amud Beis, Ala Yichud V'Ala Pnuya. They instituted a Gzera. Now, if we translate the Gemara literally, the Gemara is going to correct itself immediately, that a married woman is not allowed to be alone in a private place with another man. And the same thing is true for a pnuya, an unmarried woman. And all this is included in a gzera. So the Gemara says, this is not so. It cannot be so. Yichud doraisahu. We know that for a married woman to be alone with a man, let's assume her husband is not in the city, that's not a drabbanan, that's not a gzera, that's an isu doraisa. Diyam Rab Yochum Yishum Rab Shim Ben Yod Tzadok. We derive Yichud Men HaTorah. Remez li yichud min ator minayin. Where in the pasuk can we find a remez for yichud? And that doraisa of yichud applies to any woman who is an erva. That means she's a married woman, or she's a close relationship such that there's an incest iser and iser erva. And in all these cases that are included on the Perek Yud Ches of Sefer VaYikra, the punishment is kares, that's an erva. So the barometer by which we gauge an iser erva is chiv kares. And we derive this from a pasuk in the parasha of Mesis Umediach in Dvarim Yud Gimel. This is the case of Mesis, of somebody who worships gods, he's an idol worshiper, and he tempts, he influences the others of a city to likewise worship a god. And the pasuk says, Ki yisischa achicha ben imecha. Now it's very strange that the Torah here specifies your brother who's the son of your mother, right? And he is going to somehow instigate you and influence you and entice you to worship Avodah Zarah. Why is this so? Why is it the Ben Imecha? why is he the one who seduces his brother to say, let's go and serve another deity? V'chi ben em mesis u ben av eno mesis, and what if he is the son of your father, he's your maternal brother, he doesn't influence you and allure you to worship an idol? What difference does it make whether he's the son of your mother or the son of your father? Why does the pasuk specify ben imecha? Ben misyached im imo. In this private relationship, a ben is alone, he's allowed to be alone with his mother. That's ben achicha, achicha ben imecha, in other words, he's together with your mother. And all this takes place in private, apparently, because that's where the mesis medias situation happens. He doesn't do it publicly. He'll get into deep trouble for that. And the answer is v'ein acher misyachedim kol arayah shebetorah. But in other cases, there's no permission for a man to be alone in a secluded private place with an erva. And this makes it into a do'oraisa. So Rabbi Yochanan says, if we derive yichud with an erva do'oraisa from this parsha, then how could it possibly be that David HaMelech and his Bezdin instituted a gzera on yichud with an eshes ish? Because again, that was the language here of the statement of Rabbi Yehuda Marab Be'osa Shagazru al ha-yichud, apparently with a married woman, vi al ha-pnuya. Now, if there would have been an isur yichud of a son with his mother, then it would mean that he probably would not be around the house too much unless his father was there. Now, let's say, for example, his mother gets remarried, he would not be around, available in her house because of the isur yichud. He would have very little contact with her children, even though they are his siblings through a common mother. And in such a case, there's no more likelihood that he would be the instigator and the influence to Avodah Zarah rather than, let's say, anyone else, because he's not in their surroundings more than anyone else. The point of the Torah is to point out a situation where somebody, we'll call him a brother, would instigate his siblings because he lives in close proximity with them. And that's a brother who shares the same mother. So we have to warn against this kind of basis situation of Avodah Zarah with regard to a close family relative. And therefore the Torah says, be aware, be on guard, so to speak, from the basis possibility in the case of a brother who shares the same mother, because he hangs out in his mother's house. There's no Isur Yichud, even if she's remarried. And therefore, it's going to be plausible that he might have that impact on his siblings. However, the Gemara wants to derive from this that a son with his mother is the exception to the rule. The rule of Erva is that there is no permission for the two, he and she, to be alone in a private place, because it might lead to Gilui Arayos. So again, in effect, the Mesis situation is the flip side, the opposite of the Yichud situation. In other words, in the case of Mesis, regarding Avodah Zarah, the Torah is saying that be careful with regard to your maternal brother, and now the pasuk is indicating that the maternal brother is there with his siblings because he's allowed to be in the same house as his mother. But the implication is that that's a dangerous situation because the son is available. He's there almost constantly in the house of his mother. And that's a danger with regard to Avodah Zarah. Mesis, but in general, as far as Yichud is concerned, the opposite is true, that since he's generally there with his mother, the reason for that is because there is no Yisur Yichud. But that's the exception to the rule. The rule is that in the case of an Erva, there is an Yisur Yichud. Now again, in the case of a Pnuya, which is a woman that you're allowed to marry, that's not an Erva. Again, there's a whole discussion here about Nida. If she's already a Nida, that itself is an Issa Kares. That might make her into a... that might make her into an Erva. But if she's a Pnuya Tahora, then there's no Iser Erva, and that's where David HaMelech and his Bezdin stepped up to the plate, and they instituted a Gzera of Yichud as a follow-up to the terrible incident of Tamar and Amnon, a prohibition of Yichud with a Pnuya. But again, it's only the Rabbanon. Now, the significance of the fact that we've lowered the level of Yichud of an Erev, which is Doraisa, to the Yichud Derabbanan, the Gzera of Pnuya, might be in terms of the presence of another woman. Meaning, in the case of Yichud and Erva, the one man with two women would probably be a problem. Again, there may be certain haterim, especially during the daylight hours. However, in general, be more lenient in a case of Yichud with a Pnuya if there's a presence of another woman. Other kulos might depend upon other factors. For example, if the door is closed but not locked, then we could rely on some poskim in the case of Yichud Pnuya because it's only Drabbanon, whereas in Yichud Oraisa with an Erva we would be more inclined to be Machmir. Or, for example, cases where there's no real possibility of Gili Arayis, of the act itself, if let's say the man is very old, so in the case of a Pnuya Tahora, for her to work in his house in order to organize his house, his meals, and so forth, he's an older man, he's not capable of having a relationship, then we could be more makil than we would in the case of a married woman of an Erva. And therefore the Gemara says, let's reformulate the statement of Rav, Ela Ema, the way that Rav actually said it was Gazru al Yichud de Pnuya, not Yichud Kama and Pnuya, but rather Yichud de Pnuya, and Yichud with a Pnuya, as we said before, is only a matter of Bezdin, of the Gzeres Bezdin shall David. Now Rabbi Yehuda, again quoting Rav, tells us something about the children of David HaMelech. The pasuk says, "Vadonia ben Chagis misnase lemar ani emloch." So Adonio, which we mentioned in the last year, who is the son of Chagis, one of the wives of David HaMelech, builds himself up, Misnase, and he declares, "I will be king." And it seems that when David was dying, and the plan was that Shlomo would succeed David as the next Melech Bisrael, this Adonio wanted to claim that he should succeed his father. And Ani Emloch, he declares. Rabbi Yudam Arav, Malamed Shebikesh Laholmo Velo Holmo. He tried to fit the crown of Malchus Beis David, which had a bar inside of it that prevented it from resting and fitting the head of someone who did not have a certain indentation in his skull, which was unique to the family of David HaMelech. This was a test to see if a candidate was fit to be a melech as a descendant of Beis David, and the crown, this atara, would only sit properly, says Rashi, on the head of a person who was fit to succeed the throne. And in the case of Adoniah, he was not able to fit the crown on his head. It didn't sit properly, and therefore that was indicative of the fact that he was not meant to succeed his father. Bikesh laholmo, velo holmato. Then Rabbi Yehuda quotes another statement of Rav. The next pasuk says, "Vayaslo rechev uparashim," and Adoniah gathered together for himself chariots and horsemen. Chamishim ish rotzim lefanav, 50 people to run in front of him. Now let's just think about it. Even if he was a prince, he was the son of David. Even if he wasn't contending that he was the successor of David as the Melech Yisrael, nevertheless he still might have 50 people running in front of him. What's the big deal, Myra Busa? What's so special about the fact that he had 50 runners in front of him? And the Gemara answers, Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, Kulan Netulei Tchol V'Chakukei Kapos Raglayim Hoyu. There is something very special about these 50 runners. They were people who had their spleens removed. Now, I don't know biologically if this is known to be so, but the idea here is to get these 50 people on the move, meaning these runners would run as fast as possible. They could be Olympic speedrunners. And how do you do so? You destroy the spleen. How do you remove the spleen? Maybe you take a drug. In any event, these runners who had their spleens destroyed were considered amongst the most professional, most exceptional runners. Their performance was outstanding, and they were hired specially to run in front of the king. Now, in terms of chakuke kapos raglayim, the sole of the foot has a lot of nerve endings, and a person who's running, in those days they used to run barefoot, would travel over sharp objects and the pain would be incredible. Unless what they did was they somehow removed the nerve endings in the soles of their feet, and that facilitated the speediest running for the runners. And that's exactly what happened to these 50 runners of Adoniah. This was a public demonstration that he was meant to rule. He was the king to succeed his father, because he had 50 of these very special, unique runners who were chakuke kapos reglayim. They had the soles on their feet carved out. Or, in addition, they were netulei tchol. Now, Rabbosai, we're up to the Mishnah. And the next pasuk, actually it's the previous pasuk in Dvar Yud Zayin, pasuk Tes Zayin, where the Torah says that lo yarbo lo susim, the melech is enjoined from having too many horses. He's got to have a limited amount of horses, the horses he needs for his army, for his chariots. Ela kidei markavto, above and beyond the number that was absolutely necessary, the amount of horses for his chariots, his army chariots, after that he violates a law. Then the Torah says, "V'kesef v'zov lo yarbalo ma'od." He's not allowed to have too much silver and gold. In other words, he's not allowed to possess too much silver and too much gold. That's in Pasuk Yud Zayin, in Perek Yud Zayin of Sefer Dvarim. And the Mishnah says, Elikidei Litein Aspamya. He has to pay a salary to his soldiers, and that's the amount of Kesev Hizov he's allowed to amass and possess for the sake of supporting his soldiers. And if he accumulates wealth for other purposes, it depends. If it's for public interest, then that has the same status as money that he needs to pay wages for his soldiers. But if it's for his own private possession of silver and gold, that's prohibited. And then the third law that the Mishnah establishes with regard to the Melech, in addition to horses and gold, is the responsibility incumbent upon the Melech, v'kosiv lo sefer Torah l'shmo, he's got to write his own sefer Torah. That means in addition to the sefer Torah that he has to write like any other Jew, so for example, before he became the Melech, he had a sefer Torah that was his own. Now, when he gets appointed as the Melech, he is required to write a new sefer Torah, so he has two sefer Torah, and will see in the next part of the Mishnah exactly what he does with these two Sifrei Torah. Why is it necessary for him to have an additional Sefer Torah, and the Mishnah says, Yotze l'milchama motzia ima. When he goes out to battle, he takes this second Sefer Torah with him. Nichnas, when he comes back to his palace after the battle, then machnisa ima, he takes the Sefer Torah back with him. Yoshev bedin hi imo, when he sits in judgment. Okay, this is a problem because a melech cannot be a dayan. So what are we talking about here? But anyway, when he sits in judgment, then imo, he has to have the Sefer Torah with him. And finally, mesiv hi kenegdo, when he eats, he should have it with him. Literally, when he reclines, it should be available. Shenemar v'hoisa imo v'karabo kol yimei chayev. It should be in his possession, and he should read it over and over again all the days of his life. It means Sefer Torah becomes his guide for life in every single area of his behavior, whether it's on a public level when he is judging the people or fighting the wars, or even when within the privacy of his Dalet Amos, when he is meisiv and he eats his meal, is v'hoisa imo v'karabo kol yimei chayav. Tanur Rabbanan, the Gemara says, we learned to b'raisa lo yarba lo susim. I might think yochal afilu kidei merkavto uparashav. Very strange havamina here, that he's only allowed to possess enough, a volume of horses, a number of horses which he needs for markavto uparashav. Maybe even that should be prohibited. Afilu kidei markavto uparashav is also considered also. He's not allowed to have horses to supply for his chariots and his parashav, his cavalry, his soldiers. Tamalo or lo. Therefore, the Torah had to go out of its way and say, lo yarba lo susim, if it's for his personal accumulation. He loves to accumulate horses. Lo eino marba, for himself and on a private level, he's not allowed to multiply his horses and be very satisfied with his prominence and his ownership and his wealth. But avol marba hu kidei richbo uparashav. But for the purpose of supplying horses, a fair amount of horses for his chariots, for his cavalrymen, that he's allowed to. So ha mani mekayim susim. When do we say that he's not allowed to multiply the horses? I mean, after all, he needs the horses for his cavalry. He needs it for his chariots. Susim habatlonim. These are susim that he only has for the beauty of the horses. The horse is a very beautiful animal. He wants to have a multitude of horses, a great herd of horses. And the Torah is saying that he's not allowed to do so. The Bryson now asks me, Nayin shafilu sus echad v'ubatel shehu b'lo yarbe. How do we know that even if one sus is extra, is idle, that also is part of the violation of lo yarbalo susim? After all, this pasuk doesn't indicate any problem with one extra sus. It seems like the plural, a minimum of two, is the violation. Tavolom laharbo leman harbos sus. The pasuk itself, in this very very same pasuk, says that he's not allowed to have multiply a horse. And here the Torah went out of its way to use the word horse in the singular. In other words, if we only had the pasuk lo yarbalo susim, we might think that he's allowed to possess one horse which is extra, superfluous, and idle. How do we know that this is not correct? Because the Torah went out of its way in the end of this pasuk to say leman harbo sus in the singular. So even one extra idle sus is prohibited for the melech. The Gemara asks, I mean, this is already still part of the brisa, but kimi acher v'kimi achar shedafilu sus echad v'ubatel koi, meaning he's in violation of the lo yarba, he's not allowed to have a multiplicity of susim. Is if that be the case, why does the Torah b'chlal mention susim in the plural? After all, Afilusus Echad, we just finished saying, if it's an idle horse and he doesn't need it, then he's not allowed to own it and possess it. So why do you have to tell me susim? Lava belosasel kol sus visus. You might think that if the king owns a whole bunch of idle horses of these batlonim, then he violates one lav. How do I know that he violates a lav for each horse? And for that, we need the word susim. So this is a very fascinating kind of chakira here, somewhat typical. When you violate one avera with many maisim, then you chay for each maisa. But if you violate many averas with one maisa, or in this case one status, one situation of ownership, you might argue that he only violates one lotase, because the lotase is defined by the action. And here there's one action related to all susim, one act of possession. But the Torah went out of its way to say susim, lav or belosas al kos sus v'sus, that the word susim tells you each individual horse is its own violation. So we have both sus and susim to teach us that he violates the lav on each sus, and susim meaning even if he owns many horses and they're idle, he violates for every single sus as an individual. Now the Gemara asks Akasha, Taima de Kosavachmana lo. The Brisa seems to base everything on the fact that the Torah adds the word lo yarve lo susim, olav hachin, it would have been a havamina, that afilu kidei richbo parasha of nami lo. The Brisa suggests a havamina that maybe if he maintains horses for his chariots and his cavalry, he does not have any heter. The bottom line is that he owns so many horses, and he is therefore in violation of this isur, if not for the extra word lo, and the Torah had to add that extra word lo in order to teach us lafuki. This doesn't make any sense. I mean, a kingdom needs chariots, it needs cavalry. Why would we think he's not allowed to have enough horses to supply his chariots and cavalry? And the Gemara answers, what is the havamina lo tzricha lafushe? Let's say, for example, he wants to maintain some extra horses for his cavalry. You know, right now he thinks and he knows, the experts tell him he needs X amount of horses. But let's say he wants to add Y, and maybe he's not allowed to do that because he's going beyond the minimum number that he absolutely needs to guarantee himself enough horses for his chariots or his cavalry. So the answer is the extra pasuk lo comes to teach us that he doesn't violate this lav with surplus horses that he needs down the line, that he might need down the line for his cavalry. Only if it's for his own personal possessions, then he violates the lav. The Mishnah states for kesev v'zov lo yarbalo, that he should not own or accumulate too much kesev v'zov. El kedei litein aspamu, whatever he needs to pay the wages of his soldiers. Torah Rabbanu, we learned in a braisa that there is a basis for this in the pasuk. Of course, the kesef is of lo yarvelo yochal afilu kedei litein aspamu. You might think that he's not allowed to accumulate silver and gold to pay his soldiers' wages. Tamalomer lo, lo eino marba avol marba hu kedei litein aspamu. So once again, there's a habamina here that he's not allowed to accumulate monies that he needs to pay his soldiers' wages. So the Gemara right away says, that justifies the extra word lo. Time the kosar rachmana lo. If not for that habamina, I would have thought that in this case that he's accumulating gold and silver to pay the wages of his soldiers, then he might violate a lav, hochi avamina, afilu kidei liten aspamia namilo. He's not permitted to accumulate wealth for the purpose of paying his soldiers. That doesn't make any sense. Lo tzricha larvacha, but rather it means to go beyond what is necessary. Harvacha means anything that's a surplus, that's extra. And the reason why the Torah said lo is to teach us that even if he's amassing a great deal of silver and gold as a reserve, that too is permitted. Now, as far I mentioned earlier in a previous shiur that there is a heter for the king to levy taxes. Now, does that mean that he's allowed to amass money on his own, you know, for his own bank account by collecting taxes? The answer is no. That's a prohibition of Zav and Kesef. However, if, let's say, somebody offers him a gift, then the Yad Ramah says he's permitted to accept gifts no matter how much they're worth. And Shlomo HaMelech actually amassed a small fortune of money in this manner because he received a tremendous amount of gifts. Now, this was considered an avera for Shlomo HaMelech to accumulate such fortune in this manner. L'chora. But the answer is no. We don't find that this is considered an avera. He was permitted to accumulate vast fortunes of wealth, of gold and silver, by receiving gifts. And if you apply that logic to horses, he could multiply the number of horses in possession if he receives gifts. Now, in a modern contemporary world, we would say that he has to worry about, you know, monies that came in to support his campaign and gifts and so forth, and it looks like he's taking shochad, and he may give preferential treatment to someone who gave him a gift. That's an interesting thought unto itself. Now again, we saw the word lo twice. Number one, lafuke susim. Number two, lafuke kesev izov. Hashta di amret lo ledrasha is lo yarbalo susim my darishbe. In other words, if you say that the word lo is coming to exclude other cases where he needs a surplus, but not for himself, he's not amassing his own wealth, then what do you do with the pasuk lo yarbalo noshim? There's an extra word lo over there. What's it coming lafuke? And the Gemara answers lafuke lemeute hediotos. Now, what does this mean? That even though a melech is not allowed to marry many women, and as we said earlier, the maximum, the ceiling is 18, and that prohibition was formulated specifically with regard to a melech, we could have derived logically that the same rationale that applies to a melech should certainly apply to your rank and file citizen, namely lo yoser es libo me'ashem, that the heart, that the extra wives that he has should not turn him astray from God. Let's apply that to your rank and file citizen as well. And on that, the Gemara says, lo, that the Torah went out of its way to add an extra word here to limit this Iser to the Melech in such a way that we cannot expand it and apply it to a Hedjot who's not a Melech. Now you might ask, why did the Gemara leave out the word lo in the Psukim regarding, why didn't the Gemara derive the meat of lo, lo velola adyotos, and apply that logic, that kind of a drusha, in the same way to susim and to kesev zav? And the Ran seems to offer an answer, perhaps, that since these isurim of susim and kesev zav in the case of monies that he accumulates through taxes, then obviously there's no way that we can apply that to a hedjot, because the hedjot has no way of levying taxes. Therefore, the Gemara reinterprets the word lo to exclude cases where he needs the surplus to build up his cavalry, etc. Masha'enkin, here in the case of lo yarba lo noshim, this has nothing to do with levying taxes, and we would logically assume that the rationale here of lo yoser es libo should apply even to a rank and file Jew. Kamash malon, that's what the word lo says, lemute hedyotos is no lav of lo yarba lo noshim with regard to hedyotos. Now the sugya turns to the case of Shlomo HaMelech, who apparently had accumulated a great multitude of horses, and the Gemara in the name of Rabbi Yehuda posits a stira. Rabbi Yehuda Rami Siv 1 Pasuk says, again this is all in Sefer Melachim Aleph Perek Hey, and we're going to compare that to a Pasuk in Divrei Yomim, Vayehi l'shlomar boim elef uros susim l'merkavto Uros seems to be a reference to stalls. So he had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots. That's a massive amount. And then Uksiv, the other pasuk says, "Vayhilu Shlomo arba'im alafim urios susim." And Shlomo had 4,000, again not 40,000, but 4,000 stalls of horses. So ketzad? So how do we reconcile this theory? Is it 40 or 4? Kol ketzad im arba'im elef itztablos hayu. In other words, the tzabloh, the stables, then if he had 40,000 stables, kol echad v'echad hayubo dalet alofim urvos susim, meaning each one of these stables had in it 4,000 lines of stalls of horses. I mean, that's a massive amount. V'im dalet alofim itztablos hayu. And if there were 4,000 stables, kol echad v'echad hayubo arba'im elef arvos susim, each single stable had 40,000 lines of stalls of horses. And again, it seems like you can understand this pasuk as giving the number of stables, and each stable had in it lines of stalls full of horses. In which case, the other pasuk is referring to the number of lines in each stable. Rabbi Yitzchak had a different stira. Ksiv, the pasuk says, "Ein kesef nechshav bimei Shlomo l'meuma." It seems like silver was not valuable in the days of Shlomo Melch, as if to say there was such an abundance of silver, there was no law of supply and demand here that would jack up the price of silver, and silver now reached its lowest value. It's almost worth like any other metal of its, you know, of its size and shape. But yet, Uksiv, in another pasuk, it says, and here again, a pasuk in Malachim Aleph Perek Yud, "Vayitein Hamelech es hakesef Yerushalayim ke'avanim." Now, this seems to assume that there is some value to silver. Maybe it's not as valuable as we know it to be today, but it does have the value of stones. And the Gemara answers, "Lo kashya, kan kodem shenosa Shlomo es basparo, kan li'acher shenosa Shlomo es basparo." In other words, when the pasuk tells us that silver is valueless, that's before Shlomo Melch married the daughter of Paro. However, after he married the daughter of Paro, then there is a certain minimum value to the silver, which was a result of his marrying the daughter of Paro. In other words, that the pasuk in Malachim Aleph in Perek Gimel describes how Shlomo Melch suffered some, I don't know how much, but some sort of loss of wealth in the aftermath of his marriage to the daughter of Pharaoh. As a result of this financial loss, silver became a little bit more valuable. Now, the Marsha takes this Gemara in a very symbolic way to mean that before Shlomo Melch married the daughter of Paro, he was focused and dedicated to the study of Torah, which makes gold and silver meaningless. But after he married the daughter of Paro, somehow he got more involved in worldly pleasures. He got distracted from his Torah, and now wealth took on a special significance. The Gemara now talks about what were the consequences of Shlomo's marriage to Bas Paro. Om Rabbi Yitzchak, Bishar Shenosa Shlomo es Bas Paro, Yorad Gavriel Venoatz Kodabayam. The Malach Gavriel took a reed and he knots means he pierced it into the bottom of the sea, Vehela Sirton, and around it the sea formed some sort of a bank, meaning some sort of an island, V'olav Nimne Krach Godel Shibaromi, and on this island was built the great city of Rome. Now, we know that Rome is in Italy, and Italy is a peninsula. When, at what point in time, did this peninsula arise, so to speak, the land itself was submerged under the sea? At what point in time did it emerge and become a peninsula? A peninsula upon which Rome was built. And this is going to be the greatest adversary of Klal Yisrael, the Roman Empire. And all this took place after Shlomo Melech married Bas Paro. The Gemara tells us in the Agadata in Masechta Shabbos on Daf Nun Vav that after Shlomo Melech married the daughter of Paro, then she brought along with her into the marriage musical instruments, and she used them as part of Avodah Zorah. In other words, she basically introduced Avodah Zorah into Israel, and this eventually is going to be a practice that Hashem is going to punish with the Roman destruction of the temple. It's not coincidental that the Romans would destroy the Migdash Sheni. The reason for it is because Shlomo Melech married the daughter of Paro, and she brought into the Kodesh Avodah Zorah. She introduced the practice of idol worship into Israel. So it turns out that on the very day that the seeds of Israel's downfall were planted, says the Marsha, that was the day of Shlomo Melech's marriage to Bas Paro, and at that moment the seeds of the existence of Rome came into existence. Ayin Marsha. V'yomer Rabbi Yitzchak, mipnei ma lo nizgalu tamei Torah. Why is it that the Torah doesn't reveal its reasoning? And again, although there are some prohibitions where the Torah does reveal its reasoning, but let's say, for example, in the case of Shatnez, or in the case of Machalas Asuris, we don't really understand why the Torah prohibited these Isurim, and the Torah doesn't provide any explanation for them. These are Chukim, and we follow them as such. Shatnez is a classical case of a chok, not to mix wool and linen. And certainly, certain animals that we're not allowed to eat, that's a chok. And why is it that the Torah wants to leave it as a chok? Shareishtei mikros nizgalu taimam. In fact, I'll show you that the Torah, at least in two cases, does reveal its reasoning. Ah, says the Gemara, that's the problem. Because the Torah revealed its reasoning, in those two cases we find that Nichshal Bahem Gadol Ha'olam, that the great one of this world, meaning Shlomo Melech, who's the wisest of all men, stumbled, Nichshal, over those Isurim. He transgressed Isurim simply because the Torah revealed the reasoning for those Isurim. Therefore, it's not a good idea for the Torah in general to reveal its reasoning. Because once you reveal the reasoning, man will come along and say, well, that reasoning doesn't apply to me, and therefore it's mutter. And again, it's appropriate that the reason for the Chukei Torah were withheld, as a general rule, because otherwise, who knows what kind of violation it could lead to. Better if it's straight law, formal law, a prohibition without any explanation. And the Gemara now explains why or how in two cases, in two violations, the explanation, the rationale that was provided by the Torah led to the Nichshal Bohem Gadol Ha'olah. Number one, Ksiv Lo Yarbo Lo Noshim, and the Torah says, Lo Yosser Libo Es Libo, Amar Shlomo. Shlomo says, Adi Arba Lo Osser. I'm above this, and I'm very strong. And if the Torah offered this reasoning for the prohibition of multiple wives, then I know that the women that I marry will not turn me away from God, and therefore this prohibition doesn't apply to me. And the reason why Shlomo thought he was above any temptation is because of his great chachma. He was the chacham mikol adam, and therefore that would protect him from the influence of his evil wives. So therefore he married many, many wives, more than 18 that's permitted to a king. Yet the Pasuk testifies, Ksiv, Vahiliye Zikna, Zikna Shlomo, Nashav Hitu Es Levavo. So in fact, he fell prey to the influence of his wife, of his wives, and they caused him to be distracted, to be swayed away from dedication to Hashem. So in other words, Shlomo Melech violated the Isur of Lo Yarben Lo Noshim, and at the end, this is going to cause him to go astray. Now the Pasuk says, Uksiv Lo Yarben Lo Susim, and once again, the Torah gives the reason for that is because V'lo Yosus Libo V'yomer Shlomo Ani Arbe V'lo Ashiv. I'm sorry, the Torah gives the explanation, not that it'll Yosus Libo, but that it'll cause the Jewish people to go back to Mitzrayim. And Shlomo Melech declares, I will accumulate a possession of multiple horses, and I will not go back to Eretz Mitzrayim. And he thought that since the reason given by the Torah prohibiting multiple sources is to preclude going back to Mitzrayim, he has no problem. And therefore he accumulated an enormous amount of susim, as Gemara indicated earlier, and he was by far in excess of the amount of susim that he really needed, that he was allowed to possess. Uksiv, and yet the Pasuk says, Vateitze Merkava mi Mitzrayim b'sheish. A chariot left Mitzrayim, and it was worth sheish, it was worth 600 silver coins. And it would seem that the way that that Solomon, that Shlomo Melech, was able to accumulate these horses was by buying them from Mitzrayim. So even the horses for Shlomo Melech's personal chariot were purchased from Mitzrayim. So we see that Shlomo Melech is not above the law. And that's why the Torah, as a general rule, does not indicate the rationale, because that would expose the serious, how should I say, plausibility or predictability of violation of the law. Because after all, the reasoning doesn't apply to me. Now it's interesting that in certain rare cases it does seem that the Gedolei Yisrael said that the reasoning doesn't apply to me. For example, the Gemara has in Ksuvos, if I remember correctly, on Daf Yud Zayin, in the Sugya of Ketz HaMaragdin, that Rabbi Shimon Levi would actually take the kala on his shoulders, and Nirolai Kikoros, it's like I'm carrying boards on my shoulders. It wouldn't lead him to any hirhur. Of course, there was some critique and controversy about that, but at the end, Hashem says that he was a great tzaddik, and he knew that this would not bring him to temptation. It could be that maybe in this area of tzniyus, there is room for more permission if it's for the sake of a mitzvah. So if he's being mesamech chas v'kala by carrying the kala on his shoulders, then Hashem will give him protection, siyata d'shmaya, and he won't fall prey to possible hirhurim roim. Perhaps these kinds of heterim apply for the sake of a mitzvah. It's almost like eis lasos l'Hashem eferis or sefer. So for the sake, let's say, of the Talmud Torah of the Gedolei Yisrael, we would allow them maybe to non-fulfill, to omit certain mitzvahs, not applying the principle that applies to you and I of osik b'mitzvah potim in a mitzvah, their torosum nosam. In the case of Ben Azai, for example, he took upon himself not to marry a woman because torosum noso, because he was completely torud in the study of Torah. So I don't know if there's a room within halacha for a person to come forward and say that, you know, this particular prohibition does not apply to me, this law, I'm above the law. That has to be taken under advisement. It could be possible that in some cases a Gadol Yisrael could say about himself, this is my essence and I can't be without it. and this is going to give me, you know, although I'm overlooking something, but it's going to project me with Torah knowledge that will make me the final posek of the door. Maybe in such a case, there is room for leniency. Who knows? You know, when you talk about Esther and Achashverosh, you know, the many different cases of Godol, Aver Lishma, you have to know exactly when a person has the right to paskin, well, this Iser can be lifted, can be relaxed, given the following circumstances. Now the Mishnah goes on to the third category, the third mitzvah that applies uniquely to a melech, the kosev sefer Torah lishmo. Tana, we learned in a brisa, ubilvad shelo yisnoe mishalo. Now the word yisnoe here seems to mean that he adorns himself. That's how they translate the word yisnoe v'shal avosov, which means that, let's say, for example, one of his ancestors left him a Torah scroll. You might say that now he has a second Sefer Torah, in addition to the one that he owned even before he was appointed to royalty. He now has a second Sefer Torah. And the answer is that this brisa says, no, he's got to have his own Sefer Torah, written for himself, you know, a specific commission to write a Sefer Torah for himself. The fact that he inherited a Sefer Torah from his ancestors, that's certainly not sufficient. So that it's not the number of Sifrei Torah that he owns, that he possesses, that fulfills this mitzvah, but rather the fact that he has the Sefer Torah written for himself. And this perhaps is derived from the extra word lo in the pasuk, or at least in the Mishnah it says v'kosev lo Sefer Torah lishmo. It's got to be his own personal Sefer Torah that was written for the sake of the Melech himself. The pasuk says, "V'hoya kishivto al kisei mamlachto v'kosav lo es mishnah Torah zos al sefer lo." Lo means it was specifically authorized by the king. We find another parallel kind of case. Omar Rava Afal Pishe Nicholo Avosov Liodam Sefer Torah Mitzvah Lichtov Mishmo. That with regard to the mitzvah, it's the last of the Taryag, of writing a Sefer Torah and owning a Sefer Torah, which again is incumbent upon every last rank and file Jew, is Mitzvah Lichosam Mishalo. He has to write it on his own, commissioned by his own monies. And he cannot say, well, I inherited the Sefer Torah from my forefathers. Shenemar, v'ata kisvu lachem es hashira zos. And the word lachem means that you have to write it for yourselves. And what is this shira? What is this song? That song is Torah. And this pasuk is imposing an obligation upon every single Jew to write a Sefer Torah. And the response is v'ata kisvu lachem es hashira. It's got to be lachem. It's not, again, the Sefer Torah that you own because you inherited it, but that the Sefer Torah was commissioned by you yourself and written for you and yourself. Now this shira in Parshas Hazinu at the end of Dvarim in Perek Lamed Beis is also giving us an isur. You're not allowed to write portions of the Sefer Torah and then join them together to form one complete Sefer. And it means that you have to write the entire Sefer Torah as one entity, not piece together different parts or segments of a Sefer Torah. And that's derived from this pasuk, v'ata kisvu lachem es hashira. And the word lachem specifically, so that the ata kisvu lachem es hashira means that it's got to be a Shira. It's got to be one entity called the Shira. It can't be written piecemeal in segments that we sew together later on. And then it says, Lachem, to teach you that the Sefer Torah is to be written for you, meaning it's commissioned for you. That's what the word Lachem is telling you, that every Jew is required to write his own Sefer Torah. Even if, let's say, he inherited a Sefer Torah from his father, he got a Sefer Torah as a gift from his friend, it doesn't matter. It's got to be him writing the Sefer Torah, or at least commissioning someone to write the Sefer on his behalf. Now, it goes without saying that you can fulfill the mitzvah of Ksiva Sefer Torah by authorizing someone, a sofer, to write it on your behalf, or by buying a Sefer Torah. But again, inheriting a Sefer Torah is not a kiyum of this mitzvah. And the melech, like every Jew, has to write his own Sefer Torah in addition to the regular Sefer Torah that he owns. And the fact that he inherited a Sefer Torah from his ancestors would not be sufficient. That would not constitute a kiyum, a fulfillment of the obligation incumbent upon a melech to write his own personal Sefer Torah. So that's what we said over here, that afal pishi nichul avosav, he still has the obligation. Esve Abaye questions Rava, the kosev lo sefer Torah lishmo. The Brisa says shelo yisnoeh b'shalacherim, he should not adorn himself with the sefer Torah that he inherited from his forefathers. Now the Brisa only formulated this statement with regard to a melech in hejit lod, implying that as far as the rank and file citizen of Klal Yisrael, he doesn't have this limitation. Oh, he doesn't fulfill the mitzvah with a sefer Torah that he inherited from his father. Lo tzricha, no. It really applies not just to a melech, but to a hejit as well, in terms of his mitzvah of having one sefer Torah. It's got to be written lishmo. But the Brisa wants to tell you l'shtei toros, that a melech has the obligation to write two toros. Now, in the case of a sefer Torah shel acherim, let's say that he inherited from his forefathers, that apparently would be a fulfillment of owning one sefer Torah. Now the Torah on top of it adds another chiyuv incumbent upon the melech to have a second Sefer Torah. With regard to the second Sefer Torah, he has to write it for himself. It has to be commissioned specifically for the melech himself. It's interesting that according to our understanding, in the case of a melech, there's a chumrah and a kula. The chumrah is that he has to write a second Sefer Torah. But that says the requirements of that second Sefer Torah are equal to the first Sefer Torah of a commoner, of a rank and file citizen. Namely, there's no fulfillment through an inherited Sefer Torah. But the Torah seems to be makil with regard to the first Sefer Torah of the melech. And that Sefer Torah could be inherited. It's only with regard to the second Sefer, the unique additional sefer, that chiyuv that applies to a melech exclusively. Here we have the restriction and the condition that it has to be his own sefer Torah, not one that was inherited. Now, how do we know that a sefer Torah, that the melech is chayav in two sefer Torah? Kedesanya, the Gemara quotes a brisa. It says in the pasuk v'kasev lo es mishnah Torah zos. Let's just read the pasuk again. It says, "V'hoy v'shivto al kisei mamlachto v'kosev lo es mishnah Torah zos al sefer." And the Brisa says, "Kosev lishmo shtei toros." And this v'kosev lo mishnah, the word mishnah seems to indicate two, a second sefer Torah. Achas shi yotza v'nichneses imo, one which goes and comes with him, and one which is absolutely stationary, remaining in his private chambers. And this is very reminiscent of the Aron Kodesh, the Aron of the Shtei Luchos Abris, where there was an Aron that had to be stationary in the Machne Yisrael, and there was an Aron that went out. Went out in going out to war. Now here, we're not talking specifically about going out to war, but in any sense that he goes out. For whatever kingly purpose that he has to go out of his palace, he brings the Sefer Torah with him. That's called Yotza V'Nichneses Imo. Now, as far as the one that is Yotzeis V'Nichneses Imo, the Brisa points out that, again, there's a Girsa problem here, but Osa Osa Kibin Kamiya V'Sola Bizro. He has to place the Sefer Torah that's Yotzeis V'Nichneses Imo into a kind of a pouch which he wears on his body, and it's attached, it hangs from his arm, and that's called a Kamiya in the language of this Brisa. Shenemar Shivisi Hashem Linegdi Somit, that it's always Kinegdi, it's always set before me. Tomid means even when he goes out. Ki biyamino bal emot. Eino nichnas bo lo beisa merchas lo beisa kise, he's not allowed to enter into the bathhouse or the bathroom with it. Shenemar vahoisa imo vekara bo, he has to have the ability to read the Sefer Torah, Makom Aroy Likrospo, and the only place that he can read the Sefer Torah is outside of a Makom Metunaf, outside of a Beis HaKisei or Beis HaMerchatz. Now the Gemara talks about the question of Mishnah HaTorah. Remember the Pasuk says Mishnah HaTorah, Omar Mar Zutra V'Itema Mar Ukva, B'tchila nitna Torah liYisrael. First, the Torah was given to Klal Yisrael. In what form? B'ksav Ivri v'loshan ha-kodesh. So it was written in what we call an Ivri ksav. And the Ivri ksav, which is a word that develops from the phrase called Evar Hanor, as Rashi points out, across the Euphrates, this was the Ivri Ksav, and it's identified as an ancient Hebrew script. Now they find today certain coins that date from the times of Beis HaMikdash and even earlier, and those coins have apparently Ksav Ivri on it. I don't know if you've ever seen it. Some of it you can see in the museum. But of course, the language itself is Lashon HaKodesh. So that was the original presentation as the Torah was given to Klal Yisrael. Now today we no longer have this Ksav Ivri. When did it change? Chazra v'nitna lahem b'yimei Ezra. The Torah was a second time presented during the period of Ezra. And again, we're still not up to our Sifrei Torah. It says B'ksav Ashuris V'loshon Arami. Now there's another kind of a script, not the Ksav Ivri, but rather the Ksav Ashuris. And the Sefer Torah at the time of Ezra Nehemiah was written in Ksav Ashuris. Again, the language of it was Loshon Arami. In other words, the masses of Jews spoke, the vernacular at that time for Jewish people was during the Golus Bavel Aramis. In fact, many parts of Ezra and Nehemiah and even Daniel are written in Aramis. And the Ksav itself has to be Ksav Ashuris. Now, we use Ksav Ashuris today in our Sefer Torah, also in Tefillin and Mezuzos, but it seems from our Ukva, who is the Bala memory here, that wasn't always the case. That if we went back in time, there was a period of time in which
the Ksav was the Ksav Ivri and not the Ksav Ashuris. Now, what about the Torah and the Aseres HaDibros? It would seem from our Zutra that that was written in Ksav Ivri, not in Ksav Ashuris. And this is something that bothers the mind of the minds of many of the Mefarshim, to try to understand that the Luchos HaBris that contained the Aseres HaDibros was written in a different kind of Ksav, in a Ksav Ivri. That's a big chiddush. In any event, getting back to the Gemara says, Biru lahem liYisrael ksav ashuris veloshon hakodesh. That what ultimately happened was that the Jewish people chose for themselves the ksav ashuri, but not the loshon arami, because again that goal came to an end, and the Jews were no longer speaking Aramis. So instead of writing it in the Aramaic language, they wrote it in the holy tongue of Lashon HaKodesh. The Nichu Ledyotos Ksav Ivris Ulashon Arami. It means that as far as the... Again, our Sifrei Torah will use this combination of what we said before, Ksav Ashuris Veloshen HaKodesh. But, you know, they left for the common people, the Hedyotos, Sifrei Torah that were written in Ksav Ivris and Loshen Arami. Again, Ksav Ivris goes back in time to the original Ksav Ivri, the script that's called Ivri, that was in existence way back when, and they left the Sifrei Torah in the hands of the Hedyotos, even though, despite the fact that it had a Ksav Ivris and a Loshon Arami, you know, in a funny kind of sense, it has two Reusas, the two negatives here. Number one, it's written in Ksav Ivri, whereas our Sefer Torah is written in Ksav Ashuris, and number two, it's written in the Aramaic tongue, the language of the Aramim, Aramis, which was extant at the time of Bavel, but is no longer in existence. Man Hedyotos. Now, we understood that the word Hedyotos is referring to the rank and file citizens of Klal Yisrael, and that's, generally speaking, that's what the Gemara means when it says Hedyotos. But the Gemara insists that this is a mistake. Man Hedyotos Omer Rav Chisda Kosoi. That these Hedyotos, who had Sifrei Torah that were left in Ksav Ashuris, these were the Sifrei Torah that belonged to the Kusim. Today we call them the Samaritans. And they have Sifrei Torah that look very different than our Sifrei Torah. And the reason for that is because they adopted this ancient custom of Ksav Ivri and also of Loshon Aramis. The Gemara asks, "My Ksav Ivris? What is this Ksav Ivris that we've been talking about?" Om Rav Chisda, Ksav Libona'a. What does Libona'a exactly mean? I do not know. According to the footnote in Art Scroll here, you'll see at number 52, there's a large script which is found in amulets and mezuzahs. That's Rashi's pshat. And this is not merely a larger version of the Ashuri script, but the normal writing of the ancient Hebrew script. And he points out here that this Ksav Ivri, which is an ancient Hebrew script, had letters that were very large, certain letters, specific letters. And very often, they would make amulets from written in that script. Mezuzahs often would contain the Shemos of Hashem, the holy names of Hashem, written in this script on the outer part of the mezuzah. The rest of the mezuzah was written in Ksav Ashuris. Now, the Braisa goes on to say that we can support Mar Zutra regarding the change in the script used in the Sefer Torah from the statement of Rabbi Yosi. Rabbi Yosi says, Ra'ui hoya Ezra shetinosei Torah al yodo liYisrael il mole kodmo Moshe. That Ezra was so great that he would have been suited to bring the Torah to Klal Yisrael, such as that Moshe was greater than him and preceded him. And the Braisa points this out and proves this because of the terms used to describe Moshe Rabbeinu when he received the Torah, and those used to describe Ezra when he came on Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. But Moshe Omer, Moshe Ola El Ha Elokim. Now look at this. Ezra says, "Who Ezra Ola Mi Bavel." So in both cases, Moshe Ola Elokim to receive the Torah at Har Sinai. That's pasuk, of course, in Shmos. And then who Ezra Ola Mi Bavel, pasuk in Ezra, and Ma Aliyah Habura Kan Torah, just as Moshe Rabbeinu went up the mountain in order to receive the Torah. Af Aliyah Hamur Lahalon B'Torah. So too in the case of Ezra, he went up in order to receive the Torah. And that means he went from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael. Now again, I'm not sure if Eretz Yisrael topographically is higher than Bavel when it says he went up, but it may be a spiritual connotation here, that the elevation of going from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael, that's called an Aliyah. Now, we have another parallel between Moshe and Ezra. Moshe Omer V'osi Tziva Hashem Ba'es Hahi, that Hashem commanded me, says Moshe Rabbeinu at that time, L'lamed Eschem Chukim U'mishpatim. And this is a pasuk at the beginning of Sefer Dvarim in Perek Dalet. And then the Ezra Omer, there's a pasuk in Ezra that says, Ki Ezra Haven Levavo Lidrosh Es Torah Hashem Vilasos. That Ezra, it says Hechen. Hechen means he prepared. He prepared his lave to be Doresh, Torah Hashem, and to fulfill it. U'lamid b'Yisrael chok u'mishpat. It's almost word for word what it says at the beginning of Dvarim with regard to Moshe Rabbeinu. U'lamid eschem chukim mishpatim. V'af al pishalo nitna Torah al yodo. At the end of the day, as we said, Moshe was makdim Ezra. Nevertheless, nishtana al yodo haksav. There was a change in the ksav. As we said before, originally it was a ksav ivri, now it became a ksav ashuris. Shenemar, and the Gemara here quotes a pasuk, and this is on the top of Daf Chav Beis Amud Aleph, uksav hanishtivan, kosuv haramis, umiturgar haramis. There was a change, nishtivan, a changed ksav, a changed script, that was written in the Aramaic language, and it was expressed in Aramaic. So that's very fascinating. This is all a pasuk in Ezra Perek Dalet. It has to do with a letter that was sent to the Persian Empire by the Goyim that resided in Israel. They denounced the returning of the Jewish exiles and their attempt to restore and rebuild Yerushalayim and the Mikdash. And the Mefarshim on this pasuk offer a host of different explanations regarding this phrase ksav hanishtavan, which we translated as a script that is common or changed, I should say. In any event, Al Gemara understands that it's a new script that came into use just recently, and that is the ksav ashuris. And nishtavan then means nishtana, it was changed. And this is a reference to the Ksav Ashuri, which now would replace the Ksav Ivri, and the Gemara is going to give an explanation for that. So again, even though the Pasuk indicates that it was written in Aramaic, nevertheless there were people
who lived very close to Assyria called the Arminians, and they adopted the Ksav Ashuri. Uksiv, Lochalin Ksavolimikro Fisholo Dolomalko. It says with regard to the famous feast of Belshazzar, with the famous, you know, hand that came down from Shamayim and wrote Mini Mini Tekel Ufarsim, that the king's wise people couldn't read the writing, they couldn't interpret in such a way that it would be understood by the king, and Daniel was the only person who was able to be mefanech the ksav, to decipher the ksav, because it was written in a script that was unfamiliar, this handwriting that came down from Shemayim. So the fact that only Daniel was able to decipher the script means that it was a brand new script, and that was the change that was initiated at the time of Ezra. Uksiv v'kosev es Mishnah Torah zos ksav haroy lishtanos, which means that even though the change from ksav ivri to ksav ashuri took place much later after the Torah itself, yet the Torah itself already foretells that this script would replace. It's a ksav haroy lishtanos, meaning that now when the king is the melech is commanded v'kosev es Mishnah Torah zos, it is a command to write it in Ksav Ivri, which was obviously the Ksav that they used then, but that would be changed to Ksav Ashuri much later on in history at the time of Ezra and his Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. And again, the fact that during Belshazzar's feast, that when the hand came down, no one was able to interpret that Ksav, it's because that Ksav was written in Ashuris, and even the Jewish people couldn't interpret and decipher the meaning of that message. It was only Daniel, because he knew the Ksav Ashuris. But based on that Ksav Ashuris that came down from heaven, they created a Ksav, which now replaced the old Ksav Ivri as far as Sifrei Torah is concerned, etc., etc. And what happens here is that the Pasuk of Mishnah HaTorah HaZos, the word Mishnah comes from the root word Lihishtanos, to change, and this means that it's preordained that the Ksav Ivri would be replaced by the Ksav Ashuris, and that's already indicated in the Torah itself. I'm not sure why specifically in the parasha of Melech that's where it comes up, even though it really belongs to many, many different areas of Halacha. But in any event, since the Torah is commanding the Melech to have to authorize a writing of the Sefer Torah on his behalf, the Torah points out that that's called Mishnah HaTorah HaZos. It's going to be changed. The Gemara now quotes the last part of this Braisa. The Braisa says that this Ksav is a Ksav Ashuris. V'lomanikra Ashuris. Why is this script called Ashuris? Sha'ola imohem mi Ashur. Now, Ashur is called in English Ace Assyria, and this Ksav, called Ksav Ashuris, was first introduced in Ashur, in Assyria, later in Bavel. And that's where they began to use Ksav Ashuris to writing anything of Kedusha, that means Sefer Torah, Mezuzah, and tefillin. Now, this process already began while they were in Golus, before they returned to Eretz Yisrael. They took the Ksav Ashuris back with them from Ashur to Eretz Yisrael. And it's interesting that the historians assume that this Ksav Ashuris was really not the script of ancient Assyria, but rather it was called the Ksav of Ashuri of the Assyrians, because it became the Ksav for the Jews in Assyria and also in Babylonia, in Babel next door. So after this Maisa of Belshazzar, the Ksav became called the Ksav Ashuris,
even though again it seems that it was only the Jews in Ashur and in Babel who were using this ksav. So it wasn't really in a pure sense the ksav Ashur is taken from Ashur, because as we said, the historical evidence seems to assume that back in Ashur they didn't have this ksav Ashuris. Now the Gemara quotes another brisa, Rebbe Omer b'tchila b'ksav ze nitna Torah liYisrael, that ksav Ashuris, according to Rebbe, was the ksav that was used, that appeared in the Sefer Torah that was given originally to Klal Yisrael, which is fascinating because that ksav really wasn't in existence yet. But kevod shechatu nefach lehem leroitz. And kevod shechazubem hichzir lehem shenem ashuvu levitzron asire hatikva gam hayom magid mishne oshiv loch. So now let's talk a little bit about this concept called a roitz. Roitz means a splinter. In other words, the pasuk in Shmos, which says Tirats Oyev in the Shira, means a splinter that could shatter something, that could destroy something. Now, at the time that Klal Yisrael were guilty of sin and they were mevaza the Torah, which was the period of time at the end of Churban Bayis Rishon, at that point the Torah was shattered, so to speak. It was nefach lehem leroitz, and this is a symbol of the fact that ki'ilu they forgot how to read the original script of Ivri, which is pretty amazing because it means that the original ksav Ivri was now converted to some sort of splintered ksav, which didn't have the beauty of the original Ashuri ksav. It seems at some point the ksav Ashuri was completely out of range for the Jewish people. They couldn't understand it. They forgot it. And they could no longer read it. But it was restored for them when they did tshuva, kevod shechazumem l'tshuva, chziru lahem, at the time of Daniel and Ezra. And that's what the pasuk means, shuvu levitron asiria tikva. So from then on, at that point, if they did tshuva, the ksav Ashuris was now understandable for them. They could read it. So again, even though at the time of Belshazzar, in that setting, the Jewish people could not make out the ksav Ashuris, it was a roetz, it was splintered. Only Daniel was capable of reading it, but nevertheless, ultimately, it was given back to them at the time of Ezra when they did tshuva, shuvu levitron asire hatikva gam hayom magid mishne oshiv loch. Even today, that which was foretold that would change, meaning the ksav Ashuris, is I return to you. So the original Ashuri script of the Torah was returned to the Jewish people. They were able to read it, and all this is part of the process of tshuva after the Churban Bayis Rishon, when they came on Aliyah with Ezra. Now, why is this ksav called ksav Ashuri, according to Rebbe? Loma nichtav shma Ashuris? And the answer is shemu sheres biksav, that it is the choicest, the best of all scripts. So Rebbe has an alternative understanding of the word Ashuris. The first Tana in the Brice understand that it's called Ashuris because Ola Imoyim Me Ashur. Rebbe says it's called Ashuris because it's Musheresh of Iksav. It's the most beautiful of all scripts. It's praiseworthy, it's the choicest. The Brice now brings a third opinion, Rabbi Shimon Elazar, Mishum Rabbi Elazar Ben Parta, Shalma Mishum Rabbi Elazar Amodai, whole chain here of Mesora, ksav ze lo nishtana kol ikar. In other words, it was never forgotten against the previous Tanoim. Shenemar vavei ha'amudim. This is a pasuk in Shmos, the hooks of the pillars.
and this refers to the hooks that kept the curtains, the rios, hanging in the Chatzar HaMishkan. And these hooks were called vavin because they resembled the letter vav. Now, this pasuk would certainly indicate that the Ashuri script was in use even back in the day of Moshe Rabbeinu, because only in this particular ksav, the ksav Ashuris, does the letter vav look like a hook. And therefore, according to Rabbi Elazar HaModai, we must assume that even at the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, they had access to the ksav Ashuri, and it never really changed. Ma amudim lo nishtanu, af vavin lo nishtanu. We're talking about vavei ha'amudim. The amudim, the pillars, never underwent any change. So to the hooks, the vavim in this case never changed. And we see this vavim as symbolic, as alluding to not only the vavim of the Aleph Beis, but also the vavim of the ksav ha'ivri, the ksav ha'shuri. The omer, and also the pasuk says, "Vela Yehudim kiksavim kilshon," regarding Megillas Esther, and these were the letters that were sent out to all the medinos, the Esther v'shiva medinos of the empire of Achashverosh. And it seems that since it says kiksavim ukilshonim, meaning in their script and in their language, ma lishonim lo nishtana, af ksavim lo nishtana, that just as their language never changed, so too the script never changed. Because the language of Lashon Kodesh was the language in which the Torah was given. Nobody argues that. The question is what the ksav was, the script, but the language was certainly Lashon Kodesh. And if Lashon Kodesh never changed, then the script never changed. Elamani mekaimis mishnah Torah zos l'shtei soros achas sheyotza v'nichneses imo v'achas shemunachas lo b'beis gnozov. Osa sheyotza v'nichnes imo, osa kimin kamir v'tole b'zro, shenema shivisi Hashem l'negdi som. So that part of the brisa we've already studied. This is just a repeat, that the Sefer Torah that went out with the Melech was carried on his arm, connected his lave in a sort of an amulet, meaning some sort of pouch. But the important part is that the Mishneh Torah Zos is not referring to some sort of change in the Ksav, as we saw in previous Amoraim in this price, but rather to the fact that there was a second Sefer Torah that had to be written. So basically, what we have is, with regard to the phrase Mishneh Torah, either it means a script that's destined to change, meaning the Ksav Ivri that will become ultimately down the line Ksav Ashuris, or that the Mishneh Torah is referring to having two Sifrei Torah. Now the Gemara right away asks V'idach, meaning before we get to the third day of Rabbi Elazar HaModai, what about Rabbi Yossi and Rebbe? Hai Shivisi my Dorishbe. How do they interpret the word Shivisi? Which we understood that the Melech has to have the Sefer Torah before, set before him always. And the Gemara answers, Hahumi boile lichid Rabbi Chana bar Bizna, the Yom Rab Chana bar Bizna, Om Rab Shimon Chasida, Hamispal Tzor Shira Atzmo, Kiilu Shchina Kenegdo. That a person always has to daven with a mindset that the Shchina is opposite him. Shenema Shivisi Hashem Lenegdi. So again, we said that Rabbi Elazar HaModai was of the opinion that there was never a time when the Jews were unfamiliar with the Ksav Ashuri. Now he has to explain why the Jews in the court of Belshazzar were unable to read the handwriting that came down from Shemayim and wrote on the wall. So Gemara says Rav Shimon, he was the one who quoted Rav Elazar ben Modai, "Diomar ksav ze lo nishtane." Is my lo chahalin ksav mikra, that the king's sages, meaning the Jews, were not able to read the writing? Why was it unintelligible? After all, this was the original ksav. There was no new ksav to replace the original one. Omar Rav, bigematria ichtiv lahon. There's some sort of a code called the gematria code. Rashi says that the word gematria here in this particular Gemara, in this context, is not referring to the classical gematria where we calculate the numerical value of the letters, but rather it's a code which is called adbash, in which one letter is substituted for a different letter. So the adbash, aleph tuf, means that we match up the first letter of the aleph bays with the last letter of the tuf, and the second with the next to the last, the third with the third to the last, and so forth and so on. And if you take the words mina, mina, tekel, ufarsim, which don't make any sense, they're unintelligible, then you substitute the adbash and you end up with yatas, yatas, idach, pukumit. And again, this doesn't mean anything in any language, it's a code. None of the people who the chachamim who were in the court there, the Jews, they didn't understand this mina mina tekel ufarsim. It was only Daniel was able to decipher the message, and all this is indicated in the psukim in Sefer Daniel. My parsh lehu. Now it seems that Daniel had to explain the meaning of the message of this hand that came down from Shemayim. What was the message that was inherent in Mana, in Minei Minei Tekel Ufarsim? And he said Minei refers to Mina Eloha Malchusa, meaning God has Mina counted, Milosha Minui counted your kingship, and Vahashlama Loch, it has terminated for you, meaning that you, Belshazzar, will no longer be the Melech. Tekel is Tiklisa Bimaznaya Vihishtabachas Chasir. Again, all this is in very sophisticated Aramaic, but what it means is that you've been weighed in the scales and you're found wanting. Farsin Prisas Malchuscha Viahivas Lemodai Uparas. Your kingship has been broken and given to Modai and Paras. The Gemara says that there are other opinions regarding this coded message. Shmuel Omar, that you break it down into a different sequence of letters, Mimomtos, Ninkfea, Larin, which means that the correct letters are all there, but it's in a different sequence. So for example, if you write Mona, Mona, or Mina, Mina, Tekel Ufarsin, you'll see if you write it in a way that's up and down, so instead of writing Mem, Nun, Aleph across from right to left, as we normally do, instead you write it one on top of the other, and the letters Vav, Pei, Resh in the fourth column, they don't form any sort of an intelligible word. Is now Daniel wants to interpret that this Vav, Pei, Resh has to somehow be joined together with Samach, Yud, Nun, which is at the end, and it creates Ufarsin, that word Ufarsin, which means, according to Shmuel, Ufarsin, again, I'm not sure, let's see, what does it mean, Ufarsin? And you get the impression that the meaning of the Pasuk, according to Shmuel, is the same as what we saw before, but the way that you organize the letters is a different code. Rabbi Yochanan Omar, and he has a different sequence of letters. Anam anam lekes nisrafu, and basically the words are written backwards. If you take a look, Rabbi Ashi Omar, Noma Noma Katal Parson, that's more sophisticated. According to Ravashi, the first two letters in each word were transposed. In any event, just to summarize what's important for us, and that is the Ksav Ivri, again, it would seem from Marzutra in the Gemara, and also Rabbi Yossi in the Braisa, that the Torah, as well as the Shtei Luchos HaBris, which were given to Moshe Rabbeinu and Arsina, were written in Ksav Ivri. That's the simple explanation or impression that you get. And this creates a number of different problems, because basically the Gemara in Menachos assumes that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was attaching crowns to the letters, the Osios HaKadoshos, and explaining Tilei Tilim Shal Halachos that are derived from each of these crowns. And we know that Ashuri Ksav has crowns. There are no tagim in the case of a Ksav Ivri. So here's Moshe Rabbeinu trying to understand the meaning of the tagim. Rabbi Akiva is explaining the meaning of the tagim. Why did Moshe Rabbeinu see or know about tagim unless it was a Ksav Ashuri? Also, could it be that Hashem engrave the Luchos HaBris in a different Ksav, a Ksav Ivri, which would eventually be rejected, so to speak, ignored by the Jewish people, and given over to the Kusin? That's pretty strange. Now, keep in mind also the Rav Chisda in the Sugya, who also seems to explain the same way. He teaches in the Sugyan Brachos that the Samach of the Shtei Luchos HaBris remained hung up in the air. They were suspended in air, and there was a tremendous miracle because the middle sections of those letters remained suspended in midair. I'm sorry, it's not a Gemara in Brachos, Gemara in Shabbos. Now, it doesn't make sense if you talk about the ancient Ksav Ivri, because the Samach and the Mem are not completely enclosed letters as they are in Ksav Ashuri, and therefore there's no need for any miracle to keep these letters in place. So therefore, Rabbeinu Chananel opines that the view of the Talmud is that the Torah was given in Ksav Ashuri, and when the Gemara says that there was a miracle of the Samach and the Mem, that follows the view of Ksav Ashuri, and the view of Marzutra and Rabbi Yossi was not accepted. There's a long discussion about this in the Ritva at the beginning of Masechta Megillah, and he wants to suggest that the Shtei Luchos HaBris were inscribed in the same Ksav that later became known as the Ksav Ashuri. The Torah that was written by Moshe Rabbeinu, which was kept in the Kodesh Kadoshim in the Migdash, was also written in Ksav Ashuri. This was the Ksav Kadosh, the sacred script, and that's what Moshe observed in the heavens when he was up there to receive the Torah. And this is the Ksav that we have in all the teachings of Shas, of the Midrashim. It's all based on Ksav Ashuri. All the teachings of Chazal, whether it's in the Gemara, whether it's in the Midrash, are all associated with the Ksav Ashuri. Now, it could be that Moshe Rabbeinu, he had a desire to use HaKadosh Baruch Hu's... It doesn't make sense that Moshe Rabbeinu would want to use the Ksav Kadosh, the holy, shall we say, God's holy script, for secular purposes. And since he knew it's Kedusha, he didn't want to use it in everyday language, for that would profane the language. So because of this awe and this mora, this reverence for the Ksav Ashuris, even the Torah scrolls that were written for study and for shuls were written in Ksav Ivri. So that the Ksav Ashuris would not be the same Ksav in the Sefer Torah that would be used for mundane, everyday secular writings. So that's what Marzutra means when he says that the Torah was given to Klal Yisrael in Ksav Ivri. He's talking only about the Sifrei Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu designated for general use of the people and wanted to make sure there was a different holy Ksav than, and it would, and the Ksav Ashuris would not be profaned. And if you're careful about reading Marzutra's language, he doesn't say the Torah was given in Ksav Ashuri, meaning that Hashem himself used the Ksav Ashuri, but rather he says Li Yisrael, that Marzutra says Etchila Nitna Torah Li Yisrael, this is on the end of Chof Aleph Amid Beis, the Ksav Ivri. But again, the emphasis is on Li Yisrael, meaning the Sifrei Torah that we use for general popular use. He doesn't argue with the fact that on the Shtei Luchos HaBris, the script was Ksav Ashuri, that's for sure. And if you accept this Ritva in Megillah, then the Ksav Ashuri was not really new to the Jew, because the original Torah scroll and the Shtei Luchos HaBris were written in Ksav Ashuri. But since the general population adopted the Ksav Ivri, therefore as time went on, they never really saw the Ksav Ashuri. It wasn't available to them. So the Ksav Ashuri was indeed the original Ksav, but now they got familiar with the Ksav Ivri. And only the greatest sages in each generation perhaps recognized the Ksav Ashuri, because that tradition was passed on amongst the Gedol Yisrael. Now in the story of Belshazzar, when the handwriting came down from heaven to write on the wall, it would seem that even the king's advisors, the Jewish advisors, the Chachamim, were not able to read it because it was written in Ksav Ashuri. And again, Ksav Ashuri was sort of lost, but Daniel, because he was one of the Gedol Yisrael, he was the leader of Israel, he had this Mesorah. He was privy to the tradition that was handed down from Moshe Rabbeinu and onwards of what the Ksav Ashuri was all about. And therefore, he, Daniel, was able to decipher this handwriting on the wall, as we call it. There's a shita of the Radbaz that there's a fundamental difference between the first Luchos, the Luchos HaRishonos, and the Luchos HaShnios. The first Luchos HaBris were written in Ksav Ashuri, and he proves this from Yerushalmi that says that the Torah was given in Ksav Ivri, the Ayin, which had a different surah in Ksav Ivri, was held in place miraculously, not the Mem and the Samach. So it means that the Luchos HaRishonos were written in Ksav Ivri. Now, the Radbaz flips this around, and he says that when the Luchos HaShnius were given to replace the Luchos HaRishonos that were broken after the Chet HaEgel, the original Luchos were written in Ksav Ivri, and it was the second set of Luchos that were perhaps, I guess you could say, on a lower level, and they were written in Ksav Ivri. So if the original set of Luchos were written in Ksav Ashuri, they contained all those teachings that we mentioned in the Gemara Menachos about the formulation of letters and crowns and so forth and so on. So that whereas the Ritva understands that both the first set of Luchos and the second were written in Ksav Ashuri, the Radbaz would maintain that only the second set of Luchos, which were meant to replace the first set, those were written in Ksav Ivri, but the first set, the original Luchos, were written in Ksav Ashuri. The second set of Luchos were in Ksav Ivri, whereas the Ritva rejects any possibility of Ksav Ivri either in the first set of Luchos or the second set of Luchos. Okay, Rabbi, so we got to the Mishnah here on Daf Chof Beis Amud Aleph, and that's where we're going to stop.